Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials. In this, its third series, we will focus on conversations that treat the problem of the environment, climate change, and mass extinction. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. Daniel Matthews' recent book, Earthbound, The Aesthetics of Sovereignty in the Anthropocene, is an extremely timely book and an apposite volume to consider in this series focused on climate change, ecological crises, and mass extinctions. The Anthropocene is a notion that signals a new geological epoch that is putatively succeeding the Holocene, which is a geological epoch that commenced around 11,500 years ago. The notion of the Anthropocene is not a settled one. The stratigraphy working group is yet to officially determine the Anthropocene as a geological epoch. And the notion is also contested by those who argue that focus on the anthropo, or humans generally, is not accurate given the impact on climate and ecological systems and earth systems has not been brought about by the actions of all of humankind, but in fact a very small part of it in privileged and highly sort of consumptive parts of the world. Notwithstanding these disputes, the notion of the Anthropocene signals the impact of humans on Earth systems in a planetary scale that is transhistorical, in the sense that previous geological epochs have transcended particular civilizations, economic systems, and social organization. And the suggestion with the notion of the Anthropocene is that humans themselves are now responsible for impacting the planet and its ecological systems at that scale. Dan Matthews's focus on sovereignty in this book directly addresses the problem of the Anthropocene at the level of scale. So if we think about sovereignty, sovereignty itself is usually manifested in a scalar level in relation to populations, territories, notions of the nation state that is bounded. And so there is a sense in which our forms of political and juridical organization expressed through the notion of sovereignty is not up to the task when we face ecological crises of a planetary level. Sovereignty is also an expression of human social organization that deliberately expels notions of nature and the ecological. In fact, nature is placed as the backdrop to what is seen as human agency and action, and is precisely this modern vision of human social and political organization that Dan Matthews thinks we should reverse. At the heart of the problem, then, is our sensibility, our ability to sense nature. And this is where Dan's aesthetic approach to the problem becomes particularly useful, because he emphasizes that part of what he's trying to achieve in this book is to point out how taking an aesthetic approach expands our sensibility, our affective capacities to register what modern imaginaries of political and social organization have cast outside its cognition and purview. What is particularly novel and indeed daring about the book is that, unlike other critiques of law and sovereignty, Dan doesn't just leave it at the level of a negative dialectic. He proposes that there is a new subjectivity that must emerge, a subjectivity of the earthbound that is more conscious of nature. The notion of the earthbound is drawn from Bruno Latour, and it signals the emergence of a human subject who is more entangled with nature, indeed co-constituted by nature. And it is also a being that is capable of, and in fact must develop, more sensitive notions of obligation. So this is a book that also signals the need for a new politics, one that is characterized by limits, by needs and necessities, rather than modern conceptions of freedom and boundless possibility. Dan's book helps us to get to the point of confronting one of the key challenges for law and politics in the context of the Anthropocene, and that is to ask ourselves the question of what does it mean to live within limits. Now, he doesn't give very specific answers to this question, but reaching the question itself is a very important landmark in social and political thinking. It does see the human decentered, but the problem of the Anthropocene is still one that needs to be confronted by humans themselves. There's a contrast here to books such as Margaret Davies's Echo Law, Legality, Life, and the Normativity of Nature, which I will consider and discuss in a subsequent episode. But in this book, we're taken to the point of asking this question of what does it mean to live an obligated and obliged life in the context of climate change. Daniel Matthews, welcome to Countersign. I'm delighted to have you on the podcast and really enjoyed reading your book, Earthbound, The Aesthetics of Sovereignty in the Anthropocene. I thought it would be really useful to start with you saying a little bit about what the Anthropocene is for the purposes of our listeners. There's controversy around the term, and what it actually means. So could you start with that?
Sure. It's great to be with you, Stuart. Thanks very much for the invitation. So the Anthropocene is a contested concept, as you suggested, and it's been discussed and picked up in a number of different disciplines, each of which has its own interpretation of this concept. The basic idea of the Anthropocene is that it describes a shift within the Earth's history. It is a putative new geological epoch, which replaces the Holocene, which is the previous or perhaps current, depending on who you ask, geological epoch, which began as the last ice ages ended.
So that was about 11,500 years ago. The commencement of the Holocene.
And one thing that's worth just emphasizing is that the Holocene is a uniquely stable period in the Earth's climatic history. And it obviously has provided the conditions, the climatic conditions that have given rise to human civilization, agriculture, and...
Particular kinds of human civilization, I suppose, in the sense that it's that sort of more settled agricultural civilizations as opposed to more nomadic civilizations.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah. And the Anthropocene contends that that period of climatic stability and the various social, political, technological possibilities that gave rise to has come to an end. And we're entering into a new mm-hmm. deeply unstable and unpredictable climatic situation brought about by human agency. So the Anthropocene, the Anthropos, is the human. And so the contention is that human activities in the form of pollution, habitation practices, consumption production practices have caused a state shift within the Earth's basic functioning that moves us beyond the parameters that we associate with the Holocene. Now, that basic idea has given rise to a number of different debates and contestations, particularly in the social sciences and humanities, concerning that agent, the Anthropos. Who is this actor who has shifted us into this new climatic condition? And one of the prominent critiques of the idea of the Anthropocene from within the social sciences and humanities has been to put pressure on that notion of the Anthropos as some unified, singular actor, as if humanity is to blame. And many commentators have wanted to stress the importance of social relations, social forces, and economic forces in particular parts of the world that are mostly responsible for this state shift in the Earth system.
Okay, so we'll come back to that and to discussing that a little bit further. But I just wanted to pick up on the fact that you mentioned it's the social sciences and the humanities that have, you know, very strongly picked up on the notion of the Anthropocene or the concept of the Anthropocene. And there are many books that have been written about it. But of course, we're relying on a very different discipline to if you like, scientifically verify the fact, if I can say that in sort of quotation marks, the fact of a new geological epoch. And we're not yet at the point where geologists have conclusively determined through the, you know, stratigraphy working group, etc., whether there is in fact a new epoch called the Anthropocene. So that's controversial within geology. And the second thing to say about that is that usually geologists, when they're looking at geological epochs and looking at time in that way, they're looking at the past. They're looking, in fact, at quite a distant past. And what's different, if you like, and significant here is that geologists are being engaged with or being asked to determine something about the present. You know, we're very, you know, we're very proximate to the putative starting point of the Anthropocene. So that in itself is controversial. So I wondered if you want to say a little bit about that, and then we can get on to the actual controversy around the, you know, how the social scientists and how it's been thought about in the humanities, where, of course, the question, as you touched on, is that the anthropo, the human, that has been the potential agent for causing this significant shift in the Earth system, and in fact the major ecological crisis, is not all humans. That is in fact focused on a fairly small number of the world's population, its privileged peoples, and in fact in a confined part of the world. So it is not everyone who's been, you know, consuming at the same level, et cetera, et cetera. So we'll get to that. But if you could say something about the sort of process of geological determination.
Yeah, so I think perhaps worth just emphasizing, when it comes to the scientific literature on the Anthropocene, there are two strands to thinking about the Anthropocene. So one emerges from geology and particularly stratigraphy. Mm-hmm. And the interest here is in the marker. What is the material evidence that we can point to, a globally relevant trace within the strata that can evidence the shift from Holocene stability to this new condition that we'd call the Anthropocene? And so with that, there's lots of very technical debates going on about what is the most appropriate marker, what is the most appropriate date. There's different suggestions. The Orbis spike is one of the contention, one of the suggestions.
You want to say what that is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so and I should say that each of these suggested markers themselves have really interesting implications for our thinking about the history of modernity, the history of different kinds of transformations within human knowledge, capacity, and so forth. The Orbis spike is an interesting one. It's one that is favored by Simon Lewis and Mark Maslin and others. It refers to a drop in atmospheric CO2 brought about by a massive reforestation event. The date that is used is referred to here as 1610, and this massive reforestation event takes place because of the mass extermination of indigenous peoples in the Americas following colonization. Mm-hmm. So an extraordinary fact, I mean, and determining the exact numbers.
A chilling fact, and something that, you know, really you could say that the colonialism manifests itself in geology. It makes such a difference to the system, to the Earth system.
Yeah. So the effects of colonization through deliberate killings, genocides, through the spread of disease, through displacement and so forth, brought about the death of approximately 90% of the indigenous peoples in the Americas. These figures are obviously difficult to determine in detail, but it's around 10% of the global population at the time. It's an extraordinary, and as you say, chilling fact that then meant that cleared areas for agriculture and habitation were very rapidly reforested, because we're talking about parts of the world in the tropics where reforestation can happen very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so this huge amount of reforestation sequesters more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is leaves a trace in the geological record, particularly when analyzing ice cores that can show the long-term content of atmospheric long-term amount of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
In a sense, it's a powerful example of how human activity, in this case, colonization, invasion, and the extermination of populations, can have a climactic impact. And that's the fundamental question around determining a new geological epoch.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the fundamental question for stratigraphers, to come back to the question of the scientific literature on this, is what is the relevant marker? What is the most useful marker that will determine our shift from Holocene stability to something new? Mm-hmm. And in that sense, the stratigrapher is less interested in the social, political, economic causes of this state shift, and is simply interested in this quite technical question around what's the appropriate mark that's left in the geological record. I just say one other thing is that within the scientific literature around the Anthropocene, an alternative approach, which is not grounded in stratigraphy and geological science, but is emerges from this discipline of earth system science. Mm-hmm. Earth system science is often referred to as a meta discipline. It draws on a number of insights from different aspects of the earth sciences, and seeks to understand how the various elements that constitute the earth system, from the oceans to the biosphere to the atmosphere, and so including the earth's axial tilt, its orbital relation to the sun, and so forth, form a coherent, more or less coherent system. Mm-hmm. And it's the analysis between these different subsystems and sub-processes that the Earth system scientists are interested in. And the Anthropocene concept first emerges within Earth system science discourses. And here, the thing that Earth system scientists are more interested in when they're talking about the Anthropocene is less the marker, less the trace that is left in the geological record, and more pointing to the way in which a range of human interventions within a number of different processes and systems that constitute the Earth have shifted beyond the parameters to be associated with the Holocene. So they point to interventions within freshwater systems, the interventions within biodiversity, for example, human population growth, urbanization, as well as atmospheric CO2, acidification of the oceans, et cetera, et cetera. So it's looking at a number of different sites in which human activity has intervened and shifted these different systems and processes beyond the parameters that we associate with the Holocene. So there are these different approaches to the Anthropocene, and obviously the social sciences and the humanities have developed their own approach to this question. Now, I'd say one thing I'd say in relation to the in this context is that I think one of the benefits of the Anthropocene is its current contested nature, and the existing kind of pluralism around these questions. There is a temptation, I think, and this is something that Mark Maslin has suggested in some of his writing, is that we need to distinguish between the formal Anthropocene and then these informal designations that have been developed within the humanities and social sciences. So the formal Anthropocene is determined by the Anthropocene Working Group or geological science or whoever it may be, and they'll tell us whether what the facts are with respect to the Anthropocene. And then social scientists and humanities can interpret this in their own languages, like the Capitalocene, the Plantationocene. These are different kind of formulations that have been offered to describe this state shift within the Earth system. I mean, my own sense is that there's something beneficial in retaining this contested and pluralized conception of the Anthropocene, because it encourages us precisely to think about the relations between precisely social and political activities and geological time, that it's the intersection between natural processes and social and material processes within the social realm. It's the intersection between these things that is, I think, deserves our attention in this context. And if the Anthropocene was settled, let's say that the orbis spike definition of the Anthropocene that I was talking about a moment ago, if that became the formal designation of the Anthropocene, then there are other narratives associated with the Anthropocene: the onset of the Industrial Revolution, much more recent suggestions of the onset of the Anthropocene, situating the Anthropocene in the mid 20th century, for instance. Each of these
around the detonation of nuclear weapons and so forth.
Yeah, well, that's used as a marker, but within the Earth system science literature, the mid 20th century start date is pointed to because of a range of interventions within a number of different systems.
Sort of acceleration of production and consumption and so on.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So the so-called Great Acceleration, which takes place after the end of the Second World War.
Yes.
Including huge population growth and so forth, is often referred to. But my point is that each of these potential dates offers really provocative ways of framing our climate crisis and ecological crisis, and each of these different histories, I think, is worthy of discussion and attention. And so, if we say, well, there's the formal Anthropocene that tells us that we become kind of somewhat obsessed by one particular date that precludes an attention to the multiple histories and multiple narratives that we need to be thinking through.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you were to try to choose a particular date and a particular date phenomena linked to human agency, then you're sort of repeating a certain kind of anthropocentrism in any case. Now, you've touched on the relation between the natural and the social, and I think we'll come to this distinction a little bit later on. But But I want to sort of move on to the fact that, of course, your book and quite a lot of the discussion is also approaching the problem, the crisis of climate change, of mass extinctions, etc., through the notion of sovereignty. And so you're thinking about sovereignty. It's a fundamental set of constitutional and legal questions. And you very powerfully argue that we need to look at the aesthetics of sovereignty. So that's what I want to move on to. And so to begin with on that trajectory, why approach the Anthropocene through sovereignty?
So I had two audiences, I guess, in mind when I was writing the book. Primarily, I was concerned with making an intervention in the context of the expansive, as you know, Stuart, literature on sovereignty. There's so much written around this question of sovereignty, the changing nature of sovereignty, particularly in the context of globalization. More recent kind of literatures around populism and the return of sovereignty. And then a vast literature around the intersection between sovereignty and biopolitics, the work of Giorgio Agamben, his extension of Foucault's insights around this new regime of power which emerges from the 17th century. So there are these different trajectories within the literature on sovereignty, and there are others, of course, too. My sense was that the dominant approaches to sovereignty, those that were seeking to define and reassert the significance of sovereignty, but also those taking a slightly more critical approach to sovereignty, whether in the form of re-analyzing sovereignty and the way in which sovereignty was being recomposed in the context of neoliberalism and globalization, or those more theoretically sophisticated insights that have been developed through understanding sovereign power's intersectional relation to biopower. None of these approaches gave due attention to the climate crisis and the ecological questions that are becoming absolutely central to our political and legal lives now. It was a really remarkable fact. As I began to read about the Anthropocene and questions of ecology, which I should say just in passing, I had not been interested in before. I hadn't been working on these questions in environmental law or anything like that. I'd be more interested around these questions of sovereignty. But as I began to read around the question of the Anthropocene, the this notion that we were, that human agency had caused this fundamental shift within the Earth system itself, it seemed like such a glaring absence in the literature around sovereignty that hadn't been engaged, these questions hadn't been engaged in the detail that they required. So my initial kind of audience was was those writing around sovereignty, and to suggest that, look, there is this profound question, this profound shift that's taken place within the Earth system, and all the efforts engaged in thinking about the complex ways in which sovereignty is being reorganized at global scales, at supranational levels of institutional and regulative organization, all the sophisticated stuff around biopolitics, etc., had nothing to say about this profound ecological and climatological crisis.
And do you think, you know, part of that has to do with the really quite fundamental an influential and I think now deeply problematic distinction between, in sort of classical Greek terms, nomos and physis, or indeed in Agamben's terms, between zoe and bios, that in fact there is, and, you know, in the Hobbesian universe, a distinction between the state of nature and the form of sovereignty and social life that is opposed to what is seen as nature. So in fact, in Western metaphysics, and this is a kind of fundamental context for this kind of thinking, in Western metaphysics, there is this strong distinction between nature and the natural, and on the other hand, the social and the political. So I think part of what you're doing in addressing the problem of sovereignty or addressing the Anthropocene through the notion of sovereignty is trying to open up this bracketing you know, in both in sort of phenomenological terms, but also political terms, the bracketing of social and political life from what is regarded as nature and natural.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So there is a longer history to this, as you suggested, the nomos phusis distinction, for example. But I think, you know, the innovations of thinking about political life that took place in early modernity, you mentioned Hobbes. I mean, Hobbes, in a sense, is paradigmatic here, are, you know, central to structuring our conception of what political life mm-hmm. means, which is to rise above natural attachments mm-hmm. And to take on a particular relation of domination, control, mm-hmm. ordering of natural conditions. It's also just worth emphasizing that I think part of what explains the absence of an engagement with these issues in more contemporary discourses is the organization of knowledge within the university. There is still an extraordinary kind of mm-hmm. policing of disciplines with respect mm-hmm. to the social sciences and the natural sciences, between the humanities and the natural sciences, where there is presumed to be access to a particular conception of the human that the humanities and social sciences have access to, that is irreducible to the kinds of questions and modes of inquiry that are conducted within the natural sciences. And it's that, I think, that, you know, the idea that nature is a realm of necessity mm-hmm. and there is the human activities of society and culture are domains of potential freedom. These are kind of being put profoundly in question in the context of the Anthropocene, and part of the challenge, I think, of trying to think through these issues is through a kind of new interdisciplinary diplomacy where we learn from our friends and colleagues in these different disciplines, and hopefully they can learn from those of us that are working in different kinds of traditions within the humanities. And
I like that phrase, interdisciplinary diplomacy. We can definitely deal with more diplomacy in the context of the university across the disciplines and in other settings. So yes, we've established the significance of sovereignty and in a sense the sort of human attachment and the grounding of social and political life through the notion of sovereignty. Now you take this on through an aesthetic approach, and I wanted you to say a little bit about, you know, what you do with aesthetics here, and indeed the etymological root, conceptual root of aesthetics in aesthesis.
Sure. I mean, let me just maybe just go back one step, which is to say that the other audience that I had in mind when I was thinking about the book, so one is this intervention with literatures on sovereignty, which had ignored these kinds of questions. And part of the book was to try and figure out why that's the case. Okay, so not only to try and fill a gap, but also to understand that, or to try and try and show that the concepts, the modes of thinking that had informed these existing literatures around sovereignty, in a sense, constitutively inure us to the various challenges that we associate with the Anthropocene. And I'll say some more about that, because that brings us on to thinking about questions around aesthetics and aesthesis that I'll say some more about in a moment. But the other audience I had in mind was around the literature on the Anthropocene. So there was lots that has been published, really excellent and important work that's been published in the social sciences and humanities on the Anthropocene, that has focused on the history of political economy, the way in which mm-hmm. Particular forms of production are implicated in the onset of this new geological epoch, various theoretical reflections around the way in which the Anthropocene challenges nature-culture kinds of oppositions and binaries, subject-object forms of knowledge, and so forth. In this context, not much attention had been paid to the role of sovereignty in all of this. Mm-hmm. What is the role that this kind of basic state form had played in both perpetuating this situation, but also providing a profound kind of set of lenses or framing devices for us to organize and represent social and material relations? And my claim here is that what sovereignty does, or one aspect of what sovereignty does, is provide this framing of social and political life that, that in such a way that means that the geological, ecological forces and relations that are becoming central to the questions around the Anthropocene and the climate crisis and so forth, these simply don't appear. They simply do not register within the framework that sovereignty provides. Mm-hmm. So here I've already started to touch on, I suppose, the question of aesthetics and the way in which I approach the question of aesthetics in the book. So when we...
So can I, just before you go on to that, so is then the concern and the sort of the lacunae or the problem you're trying to address here, the fact that what had been bracketed away as nature did not appear in the I want to sort of reach for the notion of the visive. I think Peter Goodrich talks about the visive power of sovereignty, that it somehow didn't appear. It wasn't cognizable. It wasn't part of the consideration of sovereign calculations, other than as a sort of backdrop, nature as the place to extract things from, basically.
That's right, yeah. So either these questions of ecological, geological relations and forces, either they are backgrounded as a relatively inert backdrop against which human dramas and human activities mm-hmm. can take place, or are there as resource for extraction, for organization, for domination, or simply just off stage, you know, simply don't appear. I mean, just one example I touch on in the book, and we can discuss this, but the question of the atmosphere okay, is absolutely central to understanding our contemporary climate crisis. Okay, so the chemical composition of the atmosphere is the chief reason we're undergoing planetary heating. The spatial imaginary of modern sovereignty doesn't countenance the atmosphere as part of its visive mode, to use the language that you just evoked. We think of sovereignty as being organized through this notion of territory. Mm-hmm. And territory is a particular kind of construction of space, and it renders space in abstract, polygonal forms on a two-dimensional plane, which can be delimited and to form contiguous zones of authority. In that imaginary, in that way of representing space in a way that's amenable to sovereign power, the atmosphere simply doesn't appear. The volumetric dimensions of space are not prominent. Perhaps they register in backgrounded forms, and they appear in strategic and military discussions, for example, around airspace and so. But in the dominant ways in which we think about sovereignty, they simply aren't foregrounded. So that's an example of the ways in which sovereignty, as a way of framing social material relations, representing space in this example, simply don't attend to the forces and relations, the kinds of questions that we need to be thinking through in the context of the climate crisis and the Anthropocene.
Good. So we were going to move on to talking about the aesthetic move and how thinking about aesthetics and aestheses offers a sort of way forward, or at least a way to address this lacunae in our approach.
So when we normally think about aesthetics, we tend to think about one of two things. So one is a particular kind of philosophical tradition of thinking about questions of judgment, judgments mm-hmm. on the beautiful. Mm-hmm. Or we think about studies of particular aesthetic objects and traditions, study of film and painting, mm-hmm. Literature and so forth. These things are relevant, particularly the second approach is relevant partly to my approach to aesthetics in the book. But one of the more fundamental insights into the question of aesthetics I take from this idea of aesthesis, which is effectively sense perception, the conditions of sense perception, that to which we are rendered sensitive or insensitive. And here I'm interested in thinking through how sovereignty, its concepts, its ways of representing and organizing space, agency, and scale, how these approaches are engaged in a kind of sensitization, a set of sensitization effects, or have set of sensitization effects, in the sense that when we think with and through sovereignty, we are sensitized to the world in a particular way and desensitized to other relations in, questions in a different way. So this question of how does sovereignty render us sensitive to the world, and how does it anesthetize us to particular forces and relations is really central to the argument that I developed. So partly I'm looking at the ways in which sovereignty relies on particular forms of appearance, the circulation of different kinds of aesthetic artifacts and objects, the deployment of particular aesthetic devices in order for sovereignty to be effective in the world. But also I'm interested in the way in which sovereignty cultivates a particular mode of perception, a particular way of perceiving, ordering the sensible domain. So here I draw on a number of different thinkers to develop this idea. Jacques Rancière's notion of the distribution of the sensible, the idea that that politics is engaged in a particular organization and sharing out of what's seen and what's not seen, what's heard and what's not heard, as well as discourses on the imaginary and insights from literature around affect, the way in which through which I make a claim about the way in which sovereignty orders in a deep a priori way that doesn't pass through questions of cognition and representation, a profound kind of organization of what's seen, what registers, what is felt, and so forth. And like I say, the claim here is that sovereignty as a kind of sensitization device renders us strangely anesthetized when it comes to the questions of the climate crisis, ecology, geology, and so forth. These forces and relations that we need to be thinking with and through and about don't register, aren't seen as being political questions, because they don't activate the relevant kind of senses that sovereignty, the modern conception of sovereignty, has constructed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, when we think about sovereignty, and we'll get to this in a moment, we're also operating in a political landscape where the human agent, and indeed other inanimate phenomena like corporations, are seen as having rights vis-a-vis the sovereign. And in response, in responding to the problem of climate change, the destruction of forests and rivers, oceans, animals, often the response is to think about rights for nature. Now, I think you're taking a different approach to this. And in fact, you help us to think about why rights to nature and juridicalizing the recognition of nature, which of course is very much part of this modernist framework. So you have a sovereign imaginary where sovereignty is the legitimate authority. It is territorialized in a particular way, and it's legitimized through a notion of a people, usually. You know, this is the sort of architecture of modern sovereignty and political design and constitutional frameworks. And in fact, that overall modern juridical framework is no longer, if it ever was indeed, adequate to the problems and crises we face. So I think this is the other major contribution that your book does, is that you open us up, you help us to open up the problem of being in the world in the time of the Anthropocene, if you like. So I'd like you to sort of take us through the various moves that you make, because very significantly in the book, you move us from a sort of very rights-orientated notion of agency and freedom towards the centrality of obligation through Simone Weil's work and so forth. So I'd like you to sort of take us through those moves.
Sure. So maybe I start with the question of the rights of nature, because this has become one prominent response to the climate crisis and questions of ecology within legal practice, but also within legal scholarship. And the suggestion here being that, as you say, if the diagnosis is correct and our juridical structures, political structures are inadequate in the face of these challenges, the climatological, ecological challenges that we face, then we need radical innovations within that juridical language and set of resources that the law provides. And one response here is to suggest that we need to ascribe rights to aspects of the natural world. There's been legislative innovation, judicial innovation around these questions. The rights of rivers in particular has been prominent. And
indeed, constitutional innovation, where, in a number of constitutional settings, in Ecuador, more recently in Chile, the status of nature is being increasingly equalized, of course, in a very small number of places, I should hasten to add, equalized with that of the human world.
And at the same time, you have innovations within human rights discourse, that human rights, the right to a healthy environment, for example, is given much greater prominence.
And the rights of future and the rights of future generations.
Absolutely. And the significance of existing more traditional rights, the right to privacy and a family life, right to life in the context of a changing climate have become increasingly prominent in the European context. So, and in all of this, I'm not sort of anti-rights in a sense, and I don't want to suggest that some of these innovations are not useful and have great strategic benefit in particular contexts. They also help, I think, shift the imaginary a little. They expand the scope of political community. If rivers have rights, then in a sense they're legal subjects, and they're legal subjects alongside other legal subjects that have to be accounted for within the juridical economy and the juridical decision making. And this is not in and of itself a bad thing. And it raises challenges to our existing kind of modes of legal thinking. My sense, though, is that something more radical needs to take place here. And the reliance on rights and the institutional mechanisms that can enforce rights, I don't think gets at the kind of radical challenges that the Anthropocene, the ecological and climate crises are suggesting that we need to think through. One way of approaching this is to come back to that notion that you introduced of an altered sense of being in the world that the Anthropocene prompts us to think about. My title, the book's title, Earthbound. I take from Bruno Latour, and as you know, Bruno Latour is one of the chief references in the book. And Latour introduces this idea of the earthbound as an alternative form of subjectivity, an alternative way of rendering the human, in contradistinction to the modern form of rendering the human. So he says that in modernity we thought of humans in nature, in that kind of oppositional or relation of domination that we talked about previously, whereas the earthbound is a way of thinking about the human in much more situated, entangled, relational forms in in co-constitutive relations with natural processes and forces. Now, the question that in a legal register in this context, I think that the human in nature, the modern rendering of the human, has been obviously fundamentally tied to the notion of the individual as a rights-bearing subject. So it's often suggested that modernity invents the individual and invents the individual as a juridically and politically significant unit of analysis. And the discourse of rights is absolutely central to that history. It seems to me that if we are to get at the more profound challenge that Latour is encouraging us to think through, to render the human otherwise, then retaining that discourse of rights is, in a sense, somewhat inarticulate. It doesn't get at the questions that we need to be getting at. And here I wanted to draw out an alternative juridical language for thinking through these questions of entanglement, of boundedness, this notion of the human as bound to the earth. And in obligation is, I found something I think is...
The notion of obligation.
Yeah,
the notion, rather than rights.
Exactly, as something as being productive in this context. Now, the approach that I take to obligation needs a little bit of unpacking because, and you mentioned Simone Weil's work, and that's an important reference in this context for me. So obviously we often think about rights and obligations as being correlates, that every right implies an obligation. The notion of obligation that I worked through with Simone Weil has a different kind of inference, which is that there is, as she insists, a priority to obligations that are born out of our situated relations in community. That rights, the juridical kind of correlate between rights and obligations, are in a sense parasitic upon these more fundamental questions of being bound to place and in relation to others, and the demands that that places on us in the form of obligations.
So it's about a certain, you know, it's obligation arising out of a kind of entanglement, but the community that you're thinking of here is not a anthropocentric community. I mean, that's where Simone Weil is brought together with Bruno Latour and Earth Systems thinking. So that the community, I imagine, is a community that includes what would have been called nature in the in sort of Western metaphysics, in modern juridical thinking.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I mean, Weil is not an ecological and environmental thinker. So the notion of obligation that she's thinking about comes out of questions and notions of solidarity, reciprocity. That
and necessity, I think. Necessity features a lot. Yeah,
absolutely. And in the context of a human community and human solidarity and human reciprocity. Now, that obviously I want to extend that to think about relations of necessity to ecological, geological, environmental forces. And so the community to out of which obligations emerge is an expanded community that involves different kinds of non-human agencies.
And the normative force, I think this is very significant when we think about these problems of climate destruction and mass extinctions, is to think, what's the normative force of obligation? And in order to flesh out that normative, the normative power of obligation, we have to have an understanding of our, when I say our here as human, entanglement with what used to be called nature. And in fact, to get to the point of a sort of post-human thinking, that the idea of the human as discrete entities is one that we need to get over.
Yeah, let me just say a couple of things in response to that. So I guess the first is, I think, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I think there is a sense that we're all coming to terms with that we are currently living through and are going to be living through for some time, a situation in which our politics is dominated by questions of limits and dependencies, needs and necessities. Now, mm-hmm. you might say that's never gone away. That's always been the case. But I think that particularly from the 1990s onwards, the end of the Cold War, etc., it's a sense in the West, at least, that our politics is dominated by questions of freedom, possibility, and the overcoming of limits and dependencies. And
in a sort of boundlessness, in a sense, right?
Yeah.
Rather than earthbound.
Yeah.
yeah. In fact, the opposite of it, yeah.
Exactly. And I think that we're all coming to terms with this at the moment as, you know, supply chain questions and the energy crisis that we're all, you know, confronting. And a sense that this isn't going away and that we have to grapple with what does it mean for human societies and human communities to live within certain limits in proper recognition of the dependencies that and interdependencies that make life livable and meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think we have been naively ignorant of those things. And I say we, and within particular parts of the world, within particular kinds of traditions and thinking, most people in the world are not immune to these questions at all. But I think that our rights-based imaginary emerging within Europe, within the Western world, to use that kind of generalization, is confronting new challenges associated with limits, attachments, boundedness, etc. So it's partly here that I think that trying to think through what obligations as a juridical language and a way of thinking about these things offers, in contradistinction to the discourse and implications of rights, is perhaps useful. Now, does that involve, as you suggested, a kind of post-human sonography? And there is much written, has been written around this question of the post-human and the inhuman, the more than human, in the context of new materialisms and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
My own sense here is that when it comes to legal and political questions, which is what is the primary interest of my own research and writing, we'll never get beyond the human. You know, it's a question of how the human is rendered, how the human is represented, and how it is given significance in different ways. Now, the human has been constructed in philosophical, political, legal terms in very different ways across time. And the particular way of rendering the human as an individual, rights-bearing subject has a very particular trajectory that is, you know, familiar, I'm sure, to us all. The question is, how do we render the human otherwise in the context of the challenges of the Anthropocene? Now, if that is post-human in a sense, yeah, that could be right, but it doesn't involve the flattening out ontologically of all actors within the Earth sphere, within the biosphere or within the Earth system. I think it involves careful attention to the particular attributes and capacities that we associate with human beings, but they are situated in a very, very different sonography to the one that is constructed in dominant modern conceptions of law and politics. So I don't think we'll ever get, you know, the question is getting decentering the significance of the human, absolutely, resituating the human, absolutely. But one alternative in this context is often posited as being a kind of ecocentric attitude or approach. And I'm rather skeptical about that. I think that when it comes to thinking legally and politically, we have to inevitably are drawn back to questions about anthropic concerns. The question is, how do we render those anthropic concerns in new ways? And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is to elaborate that through this attention to the work that obligations might do in that context.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, that makes sense when you're talking about obligations in particular, because, you know, from the point of view of ethics and politics, whose obligations? And these would be the obligations of humans. I suppose the danger there is that it remains a sort of potentially anthropocentric, even though it is trying to look at entanglement, it's decentering the human, etc., as you say. And I suppose I was thinking about how this might be maybe slightly distinct then from the sort of geontological approaches that someone like Elizabeth Povinelli might be taking. So that's one sort of provocation. The other is to say that, well, you know, part of what the Anthropocene, to come back to that notion, is suggesting to us is that, you know, the Anthropocene is, and thinking about geological epochs, is about deep time. And deep time involves, you know, a kind of a pre-human notion of history, understanding of time, as well as indeed a post-human, in fact, looking, you know, far into the future and imagining that, it may not be necessarily another being that does this assessment, that it's really kind of conceiving of the planetary as continuing without humans, that it's actually saying this was a particular moment in time. The Anthropocene, and indeed the sort of what led up to the Anthropocene, was a particular part of the Earth's geological history. And there are other systems of life and non-life that may well supersede us. So, I mean, of course, we are not living either in the deep past or the deep future. We're living in the here and now, and ethics and politics demands a response from us now. And of course, that is what you're addressing. But I wanted to sort of throw that provocation in.
Yeah, so maybe just say two things. So one, in relation to the geontological, Elizabeth Povinelli's work, and also Elizabeth Gross's work on geopower. I these are great, you know, and I've been really influenced by their writing. And I see particularly what Elizabeth Gross is doing anyway as being very much in line with what I was just sort of sketching out. It's a question of reorganizing the inhuman as something that it both precedes, passes through, and exceeds human agency. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously, when it comes to ethical, political, legal questions, we're interested in human agency, but it's resituating that in a potentially co-constitutive relation with those forces that are inhuman in nature, to use her terminology. And so these kind of insights are involved in precisely rendering the human otherwise. Similarly, I think with the work that Catherine Yusuf has done around these questions of rethinking subjectivities in relation to geological processes and so forth. So in terms of the deep time issue, there is so much that is really fascinating around these debates about the Anthropocene, and particularly coming out of these kind of stratigraphic questions. As you say, part of what the stratigrapher is doing is imagining a world without humans. And it's almost conceiving, what would the geologically informed alien think when they come and land on Earth? And how would they determine that there was this state shift in the Earth system at some point, whether it is in the 20th century or the beginning of the 17th century or whatever it may be? What is the evidence that they would look for? So there is... these pose interesting questions, as you say, about a much longer historical time frame than we normally associate with the history of modernity, for example, or even the history of empires. But this is a kind of species history and its entanglement with geological processes. The human has lived through arguably three geological epochs, and to think of these entanglements and trajectories in all really interesting. What does it do politically now? I'm not really sure. I mean, my sense is that there are really significant histories that need to be told of how we have arrived in this really precarious situation we're in with respect to the climate crisis and ecological crisis, that don't require this level of abstraction and this evocation of temporal frames, which are in a sense rather kind of inhuman, you know, thinking of the Earth, the Earth's 4 billion year history. And it is, I think, I'm just not sure what it does in terms of addressing these the contemporary challenges that we have, particularly when there are so many important historical trajectories that need to be given really proper attention, including the history of empire, the ways in which colonial practices have been central to the production of the climate crisis, and more contemporary interventions. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that half of all CO2 emissions, all historic CO2 emissions, have taken place in the last 30 years, for instance, requires us to address a much more, much more recent set of changes that have taken place, particularly within China and other aspects of the global south, which have profoundly altered the Earth's climatic condition. I think these are the kinds of histories that we need to be attentive to, and I'm not sure that deep time, however provocative and thought-provoking, you know, these kind of questions are, I'm not sure it does too much work for me, at least, when I'm thinking about these contemporary challenges.
Absolutely. Well, Dan, you know, in the context of the challenges we face with climate change and ecological destruction and mass extinction, I think your book really helps to break open the sensibilities, I think, that we need to develop to think about this problem in ethical, political, and juridical terms. So I hugely enjoyed reading the book. I learned a massive amount from it. And as ever, talking to you about this has been really enjoyable. So thank you for giving your time to Countersign.
Thanks very much for the invitation. Great to spend some time with you, Stuart.
Thanks a lot.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.